Can you unmute Israel?
There I go. Yeah, now I can. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Angela. Thank you, Sunny, for inviting me to be here. I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Mediterranean group. My name is Yisrael Campbell. And thank you for the invitation. It's an honor and a privilege to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on any level at any time. I say that it's an honor because the life I have today is a direct result of my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. My life is not simply Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a great deal more than that. But the reason I have the parts that aren't Alcoholics Anonymous is because I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the privilege I speak about is the privilege that Dr. Silkworth mentions when he says in the doctor's opinion, later he requested the privilege of sharing his story with other alcoholics. And I believe that the privilege that Bill was afforded by Dr. Silkworth is the same privilege that I'm afforded today in this meeting, the ability to share my story with other alcoholics, really, whether it's one or whether it's, you know, 500, it doesn't really matter. I'm speaking as one person and you're each listening as one person. And that's really all there is. What I love most, and I usually mention, is that later the sentence continues, here and with some misgiving, we consented. In other words, they thought it was a bad idea, but they did it anyway. And because they did, we have a program today and we have what we have right here, right now. So I'm eternally grateful for that. For Dr. Silkworth's humility to know that though he was a leading expert on alcoholism and addiction, he didn't know everything. And he was open to new things happening in the world of his experience. And so he let Bill talk to these other patients. Though none of them stayed sober, Bill did. And was sober on the day 6 months later when he met Dr. Bob. So my story is this. I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia and I hated it. I grew up in a tiny, quiet little house in a quiet little street with two quiet little parents, a quiet little sister and a cat. And all I ever wanted to be was from somewhere where stuff happens. Now I live in Jerusalem, Israel, where far too much happens. Not that I would want to go back to my quiet little house on my quiet little street with my quiet little parents and a cat, but, you know, I wouldn't mind a little quiet. But that's not what the world is offering me today. And this is what happened to me. I took a drink when I was 9 years old. I like to say that I waited. I say that I waited because I could have used to drink on any day of my entire life up until the point when I drank. Now, I'm not a medical doctor, so I don't know if what I'm about to say is true. And I don't know if fear, self-obsession, self-centeredness, anxiety can be transmitted through breast milk. But if it can, it was in my case. Because as far back as I remember, that was the state that I brought to the day. Anxious, uncomfortable, not fitting in, hyper aware of what you had and I didn't. You know, I remember when Zoom started and everyone said, oh, I could never have gotten sober in Zoom. You guys, that's so amazing that you're here. I don't know. I mean, I don't think going to church basements, you know, it wasn't like when they told me that, you know, the good news is all of our meetings are in church basements. It wasn't like I said to myself, oh, well, that's a comfort. At least we'll be in a church. You know, that was just another strike against Alcoholics Anonymous when I first got here. You know, my dear friend Scott Redmond of blessed memory used to say, Alcoholics Anonymous, how lame is this? You know, like, you know, I please believe me when I say that it is an honor and a privilege to be here. Please believe me when I say that the reason I love Alcoholics Anonymous is because of all the parts of my life that I've been given by Alcoholics Anonymous. But please understand that when I got here, I wasn't like, oh, thank God, I'd never have to drink again. I said to my sponsor when I was some 3 or 4 days sober. Okay, I get it. We don't drink. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. What do we do? Like, what is allowed? Just tell me the chemicals I'm allowed to take. Because even at 16, the thought, which is the age that I was when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, some 6 months ago. I know you're thinking, God, you don't look old enough to be 43 years sober. I know. I'm a sprightly young one. Anyway, when I got here, I really, the thought that I would have to go the rest of my life without any chemical help was beyond. I couldn't believe that that was what you were proposing. And I literally asked, you know, I get it. We don't drink. We're in something called Alcoholics Anonymous. What do we do? Because we must do something. It was beyond. Anyway, came to Alcoholics Anonymous. As I said, when I was 16 years old, I was in the middle of my junior year at Archbishop John Carroll High School for Boys. It was 1980, February of 1980, when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to you, an Irish Italian Catholic kid from Philadelphia. I sit before you, an Orthodox Jew living in Jerusalem. I can't promise you if you work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll end up an Orthodox Jew living in Jerusalem. But I can tell you it has happened. It's not really so connected to the second step, but I'm going to tell the story anyway. There was a time when a man named Clint Hodges was my sponsor, and Clint Hodges was sponsored by Clancy Imeslin. I know we don't have speaker tapes anymore, but rifle through your closet and pull out the speaker tapes of Clint Hodges. It's well worth the hour that you will spend listening to him. And Clint tells the story when he was about to take his third step, turn his will and life over to the care of God. And please understand, I know I'm talking about the second step, but I just love this story, so I'm going to tell it anyway. He went to Clancy and he said, I'm afraid that if I turn over my will and life to the care of God, God is going to make me a missionary in China. Which makes sense to me, because that sounds like the kind of thing God would do, right? It doesn't anymore. But when I first encountered the steps, step three in particular, sounded like a trap. Like, who would do that? What idiot would turn their will and life over to the care of God? I mean, surely you're going to end up a missionary in China. But Clancy didn't say, that is a stupid thing to do. Clancy asked two questions. The first was, Clint, do you believe in God? Clint had grown up an evangelical Christian in Montana in a church called the Church in the Sky. And I'm sure it was a horrible religious upbringing, or certainly Clint described it as one. I said, no, I hate God. I'm angry at God. I don't believe in God. Right. And then Clancy didn't jump into that discussion either. He just then very simply said, Clint, do you speak Chinese? And Clint said, no. And Clancy said, well, then why would God make you a missionary in China? And isn't that Alcoholics Anonymous? My head goes off in 1,000 directions. You know, when I was faced with this proposition of coming to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore my sanity, I wanted to tell you all the things I couldn't believe and wouldn't believe and didn't believe, and all the stupid things that people said about God and the ridiculous things that people said about God. And initially, I think, and I just want to, you know, we've just admitted that we are alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, that we are alcoholic and we could not manage, that two separate clauses, I can't safely drink, I can't safely manage my life, right? It's the perfect next step is we don't have the power to do this, let's get the power. And I think the reason they use language like, especially here, right here is the reason they say, you know, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. And don't say God there, though I'm going to acknowledge that the book uses the word God an awful lot. But I think the reason they say power greater than ourselves there is because they want to leave it as open as possible, right? We, on page 93, the book is going to tell us it's further along than page 59, which I just read to you. But on page 93, in talking to the man who is now working the 12th step, it says, you know, when you're working with a new guy, he may be agnostic or atheist. So stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make an emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. Okay? I've had very religious sponsors and I've had non-religious sponsors. And the through line was that none of them asked me to come to believe in their idea of God. Right? Make it emphatic to him that he does not, and of course it says he, but we know they mean they. Bill would have said they if he had known that was going to be a thing. He does not have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he like, provided it makes sense to him. So the next time the pompous speaker, I've been instructed, I'm wearing a tie just for the record. I my sponsor, Bob, is here. I've never spoken directly to Bob about the issue of the tie, but my previous sponsor, Clancy, who's not here in the physical form, but that never stopped him from being a part of my life when he was alive. So I don't know why it should stop him from being a part of my life when he's dead. Certainly would have wanted me to wear a tie. I only say that because recently, when you have a beard this long, one of the benefits of it is no one can tell if you're wearing a tie or not. And if you're sitting in your house on Zoom and you're already not wearing pants, because there's nothing better than an AA talk about the second step given by a man who's not wearing pants, I am wearing pants. This is all the little rebellious acts that are in response to telling me I can't curse. If you just let me curse a little, I wouldn't have to make you think about me without any pants on. But because you wouldn't let me curse, I have to pretend I'm sitting in my underwear. That's how mature I am after only 43 years of sobriety. So I'm I'm pulling down the curve. Even today, that's my job. Anyway, so when the next pompous speaker tells you, you can't believe in a doorknob, you can believe in a doorknob if that makes sense to you, right? And the book continues. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. In other words, what I want to say about that is what I think what they're driving us away from in the wording of the second step is the, and again, maybe you came in here with a perfectly mature and well-balanced and supportive and empowering sense and belief in a power greater than yourself. That was not my experience. I did not do that. And so I had to work against my belief in what God was. I had to work against my mother's belief in what God was because she was so willing to share it and had been for my entire life. And what I needed to do on a practical level was get a power because I had just admitted powerlessness, both over my alcohol, which had become a problem, but I always like to stress, had started a solution, right? I quote it all the time, but I never remember it because I'm not 16 anymore, right? Dr. Young and Bill Wilson exchanged letters in 1960. Dr. Young, Carl Jung, second most famous psychiatrist in the history of the world, had worked with Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard, of course, is the man that brought Ebby the message. Ebby, of course, is the man that brought Bill Wilson the message. Bill Wilson, of course, is the man that brought Dr. Bob Smith the message, and so on and so forth, till we're down here today at the Beacon Group with a speaker that doesn't have any pants. Yes, they do. I can prove it to you later, but I'm not going to right now. Anyway, in that letter, Bill says, you know, because Bill's like, I think Bill does something very important in this letter, and I always like to stress it. He says, thank you. I think it is a good lesson to learn to say thank you, to say thank you to the people that have helped us along the way. Whether that way was 5 minutes ago, that's a good time to say thank you. Whether that was 5 years ago, good time to say thank you. Whether you have to say, I don't know if you remember me or not, I was in your second grade class in 1973. Thank you. Thank you for that hug, whatever it was. But he was also a stockbroker. And I don't know if you've met many stockbrokers, but I'll stop there. You know, he's a showman. He wasn't writing to the janitor at the town's hospital. He was writing to Carl Jung. But anyway, he says, I don't know if you, basically his letter says, I don't know if you know this, but you played a part in the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you worked with Roland. And Dr. Jung says, of course, I remember Roland. I'm not going to get into the whole letter, but he says, his craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. What that says to me is that Roland and I, and perhaps even you, used alcohol to have a spiritual experience. And I did. And it worked. Until it didn't work anymore. And then I chased that non-working solution for a time. I mean, had I known I was going to end up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have drank a lot more. But I didn't. Every drink I ever took alleviated fear, but it created more fear because it alleviated control. And that's where I was. But it changed me. It changed me. It took the fear away. It took the self-obsession away. It took the anxiety away. It really was a spiritual solution. Dr. Jung says as much at the end of the letter. He says, you see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus. And you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as the most depraving poison. He says religious experience because he doesn't yet know, or maybe he'll never know, that we in Alcoholics Anonymous run at the sight of the word religion and we love the word spiritual, and, you know, there we are. But that's what he means. And that's, Clancy used to say that, right? Clancy used to say that Alcoholics Anonymous will do for us slowly what alcohol used to do for us quickly. And that's my experience. And this second step is clear and for me, right, we usually read, did we read all of How It Works? I don't think we did, right? We just read the steps. I'm guessing, you know, I can sit in a room. I was once on a panel with about five guys in AA and about 20 people that were in detox. And the person from detox who was reading the How It Works, it was in a folder and they flipped two pages. So they went from like the fourth step to the seventh tradition. But since they were in detox, they didn't know what the hell they were reading anyway. So they just kept reading. And the five of us in AA were, you know, how many people are really in the room for the reading of How It Works? You know what I mean? The five of us were thinking about what great people we were, that we brought a meeting to detox. Wasn't this powerful? Aren't we great AAs? We should probably get a date out of this, not from the detox people, but from the universe, you know, at least at free dinner somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, when they start How It Works, that's a chance for me to think about stuff, you know? So none of us even recognized that he had gone from How It Works to the traditions until a couple of traditions in, we were like, we started looking at each other like, I don't know how I got there, but I'm just going to go back to the second step. So oh, I know what I was going to say. The ABCs at the end of How It Works. Probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. I always say that the first power greater than myself that I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous was my sponsor and me. And I believe that to this day, the basis, look, I'm a religious Jew. I live in Jerusalem. I've lived in Jerusalem for 23 years. I pray Jewishly three times a day. I don't, I keep the laws of Shabbat. I keep the laws of Kashrut. By world religious standards or by Jewish religious standards, I'm not even close to the most religious person. But in the average meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm like, you know, more religious than most of you. Religious, I'm saying, not spiritual. If I were so spiritual, I wouldn't have gone on and on about how you didn't let me curse. And I would have just admitted that I'm wearing pants. So I'm not so spiritual, but I'm really religious. This is religious. This is religious. This is religious. Like, this is all like, woo-hoo! This is e-ticket ride to speak Disney language, right? This is like the most thrilling ride you can get. It's the coat. I've got the strings on, right? I don't have the strings on. I forgot to put them on because I have the tie. But I got amulets around my neck. I'm like crazy religious, right? But at the basis of everything that I have come to believe in is the idea that me and any one of you is a power greater than me. And I believe that's why Alcoholics Anonymous works. That, for me, is what invokes the grace of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that we are sober by grace, but that we have to do the work, not to activate the grace, but to understand that we're in grace, right? Because that's what I've always balked at. Well, if my sobriety is given as a state of grace, how come Joe, who can't stop drinking, doesn't have that same grace? I believe he does. But I believe we have to acknowledge it. We have to be open to it. As Father Tom used to say, God is not codependent. He will let you be as miserable as you want. Right? When I'm open to the process. And that's not that me and my sponsor aren't two human powers, but that when I turn outward instead of inward, I'm activating a process. And I believe that in that space between us, or something is activated when we come together in that way, that is more than just us. But at the simplest level, I am all that I am. When I add another person into the mix, I have now become open to a power greater than myself. Okay, now that wasn't enough. That was enough to get me started. That was February, March, April, 1980. I believe that this coming to believe process is an ongoing. And not just a actually repeated process, because it has been that, but on some level, each and every day I come to believe. Right? There was a Hasidic Rebbe called Levi Yitzhak from the town of Berdichev, and he was a Hasidic master. He was obviously a loved God, believed in God, built his whole life around God. And there's a story that he was speaking to the town atheist, and he said to him, "The God that you don't believe in, I don't believe in either." That is to say, and I think that's the perfect thing for an AA meeting and when speaking to the newcomer who's so angry at God and so distrustful of God and so feels, you know, mistreated by God. That this idea that that's not the God I'm talking about. I don't believe in that God either. I don't believe in a God of vengeance and wrath. I don't believe in a God of punishment. I don't believe in a God of judgment. And if, unless it serves you, I wouldn't suggest. What happened for me is at 14 years sober, I switched sponsors. Clint Hodges and I stopped that relationship, and I got a sponsor by the name of a man by the name of Howard Bolins. And Howard said to me, "I think you have to have," I don't remember the exact language he used, and I wish I did, because I tell this story on a regular basis. I see that I'm 4 minutes and 20 seconds, Angela. So I don't see you, but I recognize that the time is ending. And Howard said, go out and have another or an additional or a better or a more authentic second step experience. And he said, seek out people that have had interesting spiritual experiences to you, whether they're AA speakers or people you meet in the streets or people you read books about. And that's what I did. I set out to do that. And that led me, it's a longer story than this, but that led me to Judaism. And I converted in the took a couple of classes, spent a lot of time talking to the rabbi, and I decided to convert. I ended up converting in the Reform community, the most liberal community. I didn't really even know there was anything but Jewish, but I started to understand that, like, someone might see Christianity from the outside as one monolithic structure. You know, forget that the Baptists think the Catholics are idolaters, you know, idolaters. Devil idol worshipers, let's leave it at that. And the Catholics think they're the only ones that are right, and so on and so forth, right? But from the outside, it just looks like there's this one thing called Christianity. The same is true of Judaism. Anyway, it started me on a search that has now been an over 25-year search, more than that, like almost a 30-year search. I mean, it's in the community, but still, you know, because I think that's the hallmarks. One of the hallmarks of this step for me is that it's had to grow and it's had to develop even still. It's not such a well-placed quote, but Timothy Leary, the great LSD investigator of the 1960s, Timothy Leary once said, LSD is rocket fuel. If you're a Volkswagen, don't take rocket fuel. And the reason I love that little story is, first of all, who quotes Timothy Leary in an AA meeting when discussing LSD? But that is to say, when I got here, I was a Volkswagen. A beaten up, beaten down, rusty old Volkswagen. And I'm not a Volkswagen anymore. So that which fueled me in 1980 when I was a 16-year-old kid and had been drinking alcoholically for, you know, as much as I possibly could for 7 years, but really a 3 or 4 year period there, my spiritual life consisted essentially of becoming active in AA and all that that entailed, which was a lot, and closing my bedroom door, pulling down the shades, even though there was, you know, nobody was out there, and getting down on my knees really quick saying, please help me stay sober today. And thank you for helping me stay sober today. And jumping up in case, God forbid, someone should open the bedroom door and heaven forbid, see me kneeling. But that to me was like a complete change, a psychic change from where I was. But that's not going to get it today, right? It's had to grow. It's had to develop. And that's the second step. It's the 11th step, but it's through in the 11th step, I've had to, I believe I come to believe every single day. I'll say really quickly, one more little rabbinic quip. I see 13, 12, 11. The Kotzker, this crazy rabbi who spent 20 years in his room, said that he who prays today because he prayed yesterday, a evil man is better than he. Two sentences. He certainly didn't mean, he meant pray every day. That's what Jews do. But what he meant to say is do it as if you've done it. Do it anew. I'm not saying don't go to your home group. I'm saying go to your home group and have a new experience. Don't know what you're going to find there. Don't know everything you have to know about that group because you've been there so many times. Go in anew. Thanks.